tonight's topic.
I thought I'd talk a little bit. This is a talk that I was going to give a few weeks ago, if not months, and then I, for some reason, got derailed. I've wanted to give a talk on Buddhist communication strategies, dealing with difficult communications, with different difficult interactions, tools that the Buddha offered to help us communicate in ways that lead to skillful results. And by skillful, when I use the word skillful, it means actions that don't cause long-term harm to yourself or to anyone else, that are for the long-term benefit. So when you hear the word skillful, kusala in the Buddha's tongue, Pali, that means something that doesn't cause long-term harm. And something that is unskillful is something that does cause long-term harm. It causes stress, it causes long-term suffering. So, it's a very, very, very central topic in the Buddha's teachings, how to communicate with others in a spiritual way. And we all have people in our lives that push our buttons. It could be people that remind us of parents or stressful interactions from our past. It could be just simple areas where we've had a lot of stress in our lives. There's this myth that the Buddha's practice was all about noble silence endlessly. And that's the way he envisioned his monks and renunciates living. But in fact, there's a rather funny story in the Vinaya, the Buddha's instructions to monks, where a bunch of monks come to the Buddha and say to him, hey Buddha, which is not what they said, but they probably said something like, oh, enlightened one, all the sort of pompous adornments that they would address the Buddha with. But anyway, they said to the Buddha in this teaching, we've just gone to a rains retreat, which is generally 3 months, and we've done it in complete silence. Aren't we the greatest? And the Buddha said, congratulations, you've just spent the rains retreat like cattle, like cows. That's not what I had in mind. What I had in mind for my monks was for them to practice how to interact with each other in ways that didn't cause suffering and stress. And so much of our communication with others can be, those are some Barcelona fans, by the way, so we'll have to put up with them. So as we hear, so much of communication is unnecessary, but not all of it is. Not all of it is. And this idea that people take it often in our idea of what Buddhism is, we take it to the extreme. We think that the Buddha was all about deprivation or all about not talking, and that's not true at all. The Buddha's path was the middle path. It was about rebalancing. It was about this idea that there's a different way other than complete silence or complete chattiness to communicate that would be skillful. Now, when we're very young, we develop what's known as coping strategies, ways to help us navigate through the complexities of interpersonal interactions. Can you believe I said that extemporaneously, by the way? Sometimes I impress myself. The syllables just come flowing out. I think how proud my mom must have been. So what the fuck was I saying? All right, so we have coping strategies that help us navigate through the scary world of other humans, because when we're children, we're dependent on other people. And so when things go wrong with other people, we feel very threatened. We feel like our entire security and safety is threatened, is at risk. And so we develop strategies of survival that are very short-term strategies. They work, they help us right then, but they don't work in the long term. What are some of these coping strategies? Well, I have a list of them. One, avoidance. Whenever we have a history of something or any topic being uncomfortable or a person being uncomfortable or we've done something that we're uncomfortable with, we try to avoid the conversation. We try to avoid the other person. Two, defensiveness, which is based also on rationalization. We rationalize anything that we've done that we're uncomfortable with, and we defend ourselves at all costs. Sometimes that implies also attacking the other person. Well, sure, I did that shitty thing, but you do shitty things all the time too, so who are you to criticize or bring up my shitty behavior when you're shitty too? Defensiveness. And that brings us to aggression, which is attacking. You know, before we feel that we're going to be criticized, sometimes we lash out or we build up this inner stress in the body and we try to get it out, this sense of being victimized and hurt by others by letting it out on other people. We think that we can get our internal discomfort out if only we could yell at somebody or let somebody know how we feel in a very type way. Four, external hypervigilance. Hypervigilance means trying to people please, trying to focus on the very facial expressions and body language of others to try to figure out what do they think about me, try to read their mind, so that I can stay on top of it and manage them. Hypervigilance. Especially children who grow up in abusive or inconsistent childhoods have a noted preponderance of hypervigilance, where they grow up and they become extremely aware of the minutiae of other people's actions and their facial expressions and any little thing they say, trying to read betrayal or project when somebody is not, you know, viewing them favorably. We're trying to read their minds because we feel so vulnerable to other people. We want to somehow figure out what their hidden agenda is by reading it from them. And number five, dishonesty, which is trying to manage how other people feel about us by changing or managing the truth. And the first four the Buddha said he could work with, but the fifth the Buddha said, if you're still considering lying as a way to go through life, then you're not really ready for the spiritual path. He said to his son, when his son was 7 years old, and asking him for basic lessons in the spiritual voyage through life, the first thing the Buddha said was that somebody who was dishonest could never learn from their own actions, could never undertake. So that doesn't mean if we've ever told a lie, God knows I have, but it means that we have to get to a place where we're willing to try a different way of dealing with people. At the very least, we make not lying part of our practice. And then we move on to these other strategies that I'll talk to you about. Yeah, I guess I have a loud voice, but I don't know that I can keep up with 30 Barcelona, drunk Barcelona fans. I used to like that team too. All right. So these are short-term solutions, right? They work in the short term. They help us, like, avoiding things or people-pleasing or reading other people's expressions. In the short term, they work. But in the long term, they have rather disastrous effects. For example, if we're constantly hypervigilant, reading other people's expressions, trying to read their minds, figure out what they're thinking about us, that makes us consistently insecure through life. It reinforces this idea that other people's internal agendas and what they think about us is important and is something of spiritual value. It's not. If you try to make your happiness and peace based on knowing what other people think about you, forget about it. You've just written off any chance of peace and happiness in your life. Because you will never know what people are thinking about you, and furthermore, it's totally unimportant. Because guess what? People's thoughts change all the time. They could one moment be thinking something totally nasty about you, and the next be thinking something totally benevolent or disinterested, and it really doesn't matter. The Buddha said what's important is knowing that we are being skillful, not worrying what other people think about us or living from their praise or approval. So these strategies tend to make us insecure in the long term. The more we feel we have to manage others, the more we feel that we have to monitor others and control the truth and defend ourselves immediately, we live in this very reactive place where we don't even give ourselves permission to see what's really true before we talk. We immediately have to defend ourselves. Immediately, the moment we think someone is criticizing, we feel sometimes the need to explain why we've done what we've done, or when things go sour in a relationship, we feel that we immediately need to make our side known. More so, these are also what's known as asavas. It's a phrase the Buddha used which means they keep the mind flowing outwards with this idea that if I can control that other person, if I can somehow make them say what I want them to say or do what I want them to do, if I can only make this person say how much they love me or want to admire me or that I'm right, that everything will be okay, my happiness and my peace becomes contingent on you doing what I want you to do. That's a vijasava, which means the ignorance that all of our happiness can be accomplished out there. And it can't be, because all of our discomfort is in here. It's not out there. It's in the mind. People acting the way you want them to is only a temporary relief. If you get somebody to finally admit you're right, probably because you've beaten them up long enough or harangued them long enough or whatever, but if you get somebody to finally admit we're right, then the mind moves on to another person. The mind is not satisfied by external solves. It simply finds another irritating thing. The only solution that works is an internal one. Because in the end of the day, the only thing we can control is how we're using our own mind. Now they move to noise. I can't control them. See? That's what it's like with other people. I can, the more I try to wish them away, and they'll just bring out noisemakers. If I make it my mission to control them, they'll probably bring out cannons next. Yes, they brought out the bongos. That's I don't. All right. So the Buddha wanted mindfulness and awareness and heedfulness to be part of all of our practice. And so, I'm going to now go through the seven skillful ways or skillful approaches to communication. Seven communication strategies that will work, that have worked for 2,500 years. And so, let's start with number one, sati, which means mindfulness. It means dropping whatever story we go into our conversations and communications with and letting go of the entire history, the past, what we expect to happen in the future, and become present. When we drop this expectation, this the last five conversations I've had with this person have been awful, or this person hasn't, you know, been honest with me, or they haven't done what I wanted them to do, or I've just been tense with them, it's going to go this way. We immediately create a fait accompli. We become defensive. We start falling into this pattern of expecting, and we unconsciously move the conversation in that direction. We no longer open to the possibility of what's going to happen. When I was a few years back, when my dad was still alive and I visited him in the assisted living facility, I had had decades of difficulties with my dad. My dad was, like me, he was an alcoholic, and he, like me, got sober, but he got sober much later in life, and he could be very, very brutal. And even after he got sober, he could be very, very difficult and unskillful. He'd latch into, you know, the topic that would make me the most uncomfortable and really try to get in there and mess about in other people's lives. And rather than, you know, I really focused on letting go of the expectation every time I would go in to visit him, that that's the way it would run out, that would play out that same way. I'd let go of our history. I'd just become very present, you know, with the breath, the body, and I would use that to open up to whatever would actually occur rather than what I expected to occur. And very often, dropping that expectation made me realize that I was hyper-focused on those unskillfulness, and a lot of the time my dad was actually really quite funny and quite hilarious in his own completely insane way. And when I let go of that history, I opened up to focus on the other things other than just the little things he said that I didn't like. I was able to focus more and guide the conversations more in directions that I wanted them to go. And I was able to open up to just who he really was, rather than live in this sense of being a victim or this sense of I had been, you know, I didn't have like the dad that I wanted. We all don't have the parents that we really want, or most of us don't. So I let go of that, and I found that we were able to have a really richly rewarding relationship at the end. But it wasn't dependent on me changing him. It was dependent on me letting go of our history and opening to everything that was happening and really being really open to the present. So that's, I think, one of the most extremely important tools. The second is samadhi, which means to, before we interact, really relax the breath and the body, really bring inner peace. Because the more we're peaceful inside and relaxed, the more we'll less be constantly flowing outwards, worrying about what the person is doing, thinking, saying, trying to manage them. The more I'm relaxed in my own body, you can be doing all your shit or not. You can be totally skillful, right? But if I'm peaceful in here, in the body, then I'm not balanced externally. There's this old saying in martial arts, like I know a fuck about what I'm talking about, but I've heard it from friends, that a lot of the spiritual part of martial arts is keeping a good center balance, is not being, you know, balanced externally, but having a sense of internal centeredness, so that when somebody comes after you, you're not out of balance, you're not already outside of your body, you're actually in your body, balanced, relaxed, comfortable. So you can choose whether or not to respond. Or you don't want to react. The more we react, right, that's because we're more externally focused. We're not comfortable anywhere. And if we're stressed out in here, we're going to wind up doing things that are unskillful out there in our interactions with people. If we're relaxed in here, we will more likely be able to just allow something really stupid, if it happens, to float by before we need to immediately react. And when we do that, when we have that pause, that magical spiritual pause, as Tara Brach calls us, we have choices. When we're driven by reaction, we're not really truly experiencing free will. When you only have one choice, or when I only have one choice of how to behave, that's not free will. But if I have choices, if I have opportunities, if I have more than one way that's not just reactive, that's not just defensive, that's free will. That means I'm truly exercising my consciousness, my sense of control over my life. So three is yonisa manasikara, which means being appropriately attentive throughout, not just relaxing the body and leaving it as that, but when you start feeling a mood arising, an anger or a sense of something that you absolutely need to say, notice how it's affecting the body. Notice how it makes the mind change, how it makes the mind more claustrophobic or it relaxes the mind. Notice what effect each idea or each thing you want to say has on the body. You don't have to simply immediately say something. I don't have to immediately say something. It really comes down to first noticing how it affects my body, how it affects the mind. Is this something that's bringing inner peace, or is this something that, is this idea just, you know, stirring me up, creating mental agitation? Now, one of the most important practices, the Buddha, and I want to say the Pali word for it, susati, I always forget that one, susati, it means to listen deeply without interruption, without preparing our response while someone's talking to us. Often, when we go into that eternal place of, oh, they're saying this shit or that shit, you know, before we truly hear them out, before we truly try to get to the feelings of what they're saying rather than the facts, we are already preparing our response, and we're not really there anymore. We're not really hearing what's behind what the person is saying. Part of the problem with our coping strategies, I know from mine, is that they keep me focused on the subjectivity of the facts as I've experienced them, on my believing that they're objective. In other words, to put this in a way that's understandable, because that made no sense whatsoever, I tend to believe that the way I've experienced things is the truth, that I really know what the truth is, that everything as I've experienced it is facts, not subjective experiences. They're facts. And so when somebody says something that disagrees with the way I've experienced the facts in the past, if I'm having an argument with them about, oh, no, you said this or you did that, by believing that I've experienced the truth, I'm no longer open to the possibility, A, that there are multiple truths available, B, in the end, the facts are not as important as the feelings. What feelings are the other person saying? They can say, for example, you don't ever, you don't do this, whatever. You don't take into consideration what I want, whatever. And then I could list off, oh, yeah, I do care what you want. I cared on Wednesday what you wanted. And on Monday, that time that I asked you, what do you want? That showed that I care what you want. So I'm bombarding you with facts instead of understanding that in there is a feeling that you're not being heard, that you're not having somebody really open to what your needs are. That's what the feeling is. If I let go of the facts and go to those feelings, I don't have to defend myself, because everybody has a right to feelings, right? You can even feel, oh, this guy is so irritating, he keeps talking, you know, that's fine, right? So long as it's a feeling, not an objective statement of fact, I can totally live with it. So long as I go to the feelings, that's going to make it okay. But the moment I live in facts, and I'm hearing the facts, and I'm not listening to what's behind them, susati, then I'm missing the point. So deep listening means I'm making a pact with myself not to interrupt. Part of one of the skillful things I've learned in relationships is when there's an argument, is to have a time when one person can share whatever they want to say without me interrupting and then vice versa. And it's a practice that works. Even if they're saying something that makes me so uncomfortable, that gives me such a practice of, again, rebalancing, bringing the awareness within, relaxing the body, yoniso manasikara, noticing how my thoughts are affecting me, and really opening to the possibility that this other person has a right to their feelings, just as I have a right to mine. And the more that I'm empathizing, basing on feelings rather than debating facts, the more there is a possibility of there being a skillful communication as the result. It's a very important practice. But if all that ability to empathize with another person's feelings is born of opening and not interrupting and really hearing without this underlying
No,
that's not the way to happen. Is it my turn yet? You know, if we're there, if we're debating the facts, then we're not really hearing the real thing that's asking to really... When people use facts, you don't do this, you didn't do that then and that then, what they're really wanting is for their feelings to be heard. And when you hear somebody's feelings and you repeat them back, I've found in my case, when I repeat back somebody's feelings, it doesn't mean I'm agreeing that I have to do anything different, but it means that I'm saying at least I've heard what your feelings are, what you're trying to get across. You can be furious with me. You made Dharma punks on this, you know, topic, and it's never a topic I want to hear about, and you're talking about this stuff, and why isn't it not this other stuff? And if I really hear, rather than debate, if I hear what's getting across, then I can repeat it back to you and say, what I hear you saying is this. And then, I guarantee it, both people in the communication feel a lot better. It doesn't mean that anybody's even agreed to change or do anything better. But if I can repeat back to you what feeling you're trying to get across from to me, I hear that you're feeling frustrated with me. I hear that you're feeling upset with me. I hear that you're feeling not being that I'm not hearing you, whatever. If I repeat that back to you, I guarantee you, you'll feel more comfortable with me. Finally, Samavaka, the right speech itself, comes with two sets of core understandings. The first is a sense of what the Buddha called what's appropriate, what we call boundaries. Now, the greatest misunderstanding with boundaries is that it's something that we erect to keep other people from doing things we don't like. You hear the phrase, that person has terrible boundaries. When you hear that, it means that the person who's saying it, they haven't done their work. They haven't set their boundaries. Boundaries are not for other people. They're for us, to keep ourselves from talking about things that cause stress and suffering, from doing and engaging in topics that hurt us. So when I set a boundary with you, it's not constraining you. You can bring up whatever topic you want. I'm setting a limit for myself about what I'm willing to talk about. So it's not about reining you in, it's about reining me in. You can bring up things that I don't want to hear. My dad used to bring up, oh my God, crazy shit that was so inappropriate, but the real thing that I had to do was not monitor or constrain him, but was to say, nah, I'm not going to talk about that. Nah. And if you read the Pali Canon, the Buddha's teachings, throughout there was teaching after teaching after teaching where somebody would go to the Buddha and say, you know, let's talk about this. And the Buddha would say, no, with Vajjhagodha. I want to talk about where the universe came from. No. I want to talk about what's going to happen to you after you die. No, not going to talk about it. I'm not going to talk about it. The Buddha went down the list. There was 20 questions, and the Buddha was saying, no, no, no. And also with Potapata, the same thing. The guy comes to him with all these topics he wants to talk about, all these, you know, things about the Buddha's past. Buddha's like, no,
Not going to talk about it. Not going to do it. Not going to go there. He said, I wrote down the quote, the Buddha said, "This topic is not conducive to my goal, which is living a skillful life. This topic doesn't lead to dispassion, to calm, to wisdom, to awakening. Awakening is not worthy of conversation." That's it. So he's managing what he's going to talk about. So we don't have to erect boundaries for other people. We erect it for ourselves. We know what we're capable of talking about, when we are, and we're not obligated to play defense or go or talk about stuff that we're not ready to talk about. This is a very important yoniso or samavacha. It's very, very crucial that we constantly have a sense about what topics, what subjects we can address calmly, productively, and what we don't. And rather than attack or defend or get outraged when somebody brings up a topic, we simply say, no, not going to go there. That's all that's needed. That's all needed. I've found that it takes two to tango, and that if I don't want a tango, there's not going to be a tango. I hate that metaphor, but it's true. Finally, the last strategy is panditam ka savana, Kalyana Mitaka, which simply means that we build practice for good communications by having skillful people in our lives. People who are in 12-step programs know that when working on character defects, the safest place to do it is in a 12-step program, where you're around other people who are also trying to work on being skillful. The same with Buddhist groups. Here's a place where there are wise people, where we can talk and practice developing the skills for communications, where if there's some topic that we need to talk about with someone else, we can first air it with somebody that we trust, rather than simply wait and go into the battle. We can rehearse with somebody and see if it's really a topic that we have prepared, if we've seen all the different sides to, if we're choosing an appropriate way of bringing the conversation about. So having a safe place, safe, wise friends, as the Buddha called it, is so important. Throughout the Buddha's teachings, he said that core to the spiritual path is having the foundation of wise friends in our lives, where we practice everything. And in fact, in his teaching to his son, Rahula, when he said, if you've done something that you're ashamed about, or if somebody's done something that's angry, that you're angry about, rather than going to that person first, find someone wise and first talk with them before you run after the person that you're furious with. And that diffuses it by letting it out, by hearing what we've been going through, by externalizing it with somebody we trust, we can really hear what the truth is. Because sometimes when we're engaged in conflict, we really don't hear what the truth of our words is. But when we're with somebody we trust, somebody who's wise, when we say what's going on, we can hear when we're being too defensive, when we're being when our buttons are being pushed too easy, or whatever. So, to go over the strategies again, one, sati, complete commitment to dropping the stories of the past and the future, our expectations and being present. Two, samadhi, relax what's going on. Keep yourself relaxed before you go into the conversation. Relax the breath, the feelings, the body state. Yonisa Manasikara, before we say things, see if they start to disturb and lead to a state of inner sense of stress. Four, Sususati, which means, and I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that Pali word right, but it means listening. When we are in communication, really try to hear the feelings and don't prepare our defense while the other person is talking. Really try to hear what's going on. Let them have their say and try to get to the feelings behind it. Five, samavaka, which means
having appropriate boundaries, appropriate sense of what we can talk about, speaking from the truth, never using dishonesty as an approach, having a sense of when the time is appropriate, and finally associating with wise people so that we can practice and see what strategies work well and when we're being too defensive or too stirred up. So I hope you got something from tonight's discussion, tonight's talk. And now is the time for me to turn it over to you if there's any questions or any thoughts that tonight's talk has brought about. So thanks for listening.